I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor, as today we talk about the management of HER2-positive breast cancer with Dr. Hope Rugo from the University of California, San Francisco. We have a great faculty for this program. This is one of the results of the survey we're going to show later, but there are many more there for you to check out, and a lot of slides at the end of the slide deck for your reference. As always, we have a bunch of docs will be presenting cases. Community-based general medical oncologists will be presenting cases for Dr. Rugo to comment on. We're going to start out talking about the DESTINY-03 study that, of course, was presented at ESMO. We've been talking about that ever since it was presented. Then we'll jump into case presentations. Then we're going to talk a little bit about what's coming up in San Antonio. Most of the abstracts are already up, so we can chat a little bit about what we've seen so far. But I hope I just want to reflect back on our week, and our weeks nowadays are pretty interesting. We started out on Monday, as we do like four or five webinars every week. This week, we start out with Dr. Luke from University of Pittsburgh talking about BRAF-positive melanoma. Then we flipped over to Dr. Sarter talking about prostate cancer. Last night, with Dr. Wee from Australia talking about AML. And I bring that up because a number of issues came up this week that I think are kind of relevant that I wanted to get your take on. First, in the prostate program, we saw that previously third-line therapy of prostate cancer was, or second-line really, if you consider androgen deprivation a baseline. Up to now, it's been cabazitaxel and chemotherapy. Dr. Sarter saying lutetium is now going to be moving up, but we're expecting the approval early in 2022. So it looks like second-line therapy of prostate cancer is about to change. And I think just sort of thinking about it, breast cancer, you know, we think about it almost like three diseases, just like our satellites. We've had sacituzumab move up into triple-negative breast cancer. Maybe it'll end up in ER-positive as well. And we're about to see a presentation on an oral SERD. We haven't seen the abstract because it's embargoed, but we'll see whether or not we have new second-line hormonal therapy in ER-positive metastatic disease. And, of course, we want to get Dr. Rugo's take on the DESTINY-03 study. We've talked a lot about this already and the incredible results of the hazard rate of PFS of 0.28, a survival benefit of 0.56. Looks like maybe less interstitial lung disease than we were seeing in more advanced studies. And this is a table from some data that's going to be presented at San Antonio by Dr. Hurwitz, more data from the DESTINY-03 study. But interestingly, looking at, particularly I thought was interesting, hormone receptor positive negative, pretty much the same hazard rate all the way down the line. So Hope, I just wanted to kind of get your take on DESTINY-03. What do you think it means for clinical practice today? And also, what does it mean in terms of new trials coming up and being designed for the future? Any thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, we haven't seen a drug with this much efficacy in a long time. I think since we started using trastuzumab for HER2-positive breast cancer. So I really liken it to that kind of an experience where we now have another drug which has superior efficacy. There's obviously a differential toxicity profile, which we had some concerns about before seeing the results from DESTINY-Breast03. So I think that the implications are both for efficacy and use and toxicity. So the first is that, you know, hugely better than T-DM1 in this situation. We had already seen that T-DM1 in an Amelia-like fashion in patients who also had pertuzumab in a sort of real-world retrospective setting was a little less efficacious than it had been in Amelia, just have more heavily pretreated. And that sort of maybe co-resistance to microtubule inhibitors. But trastuzumab deruxtecan doesn't have that. So we saw this huge efficacy. So then, of course, the next thing you want to do is see if you can move it to earlier lines of therapy. And there is a first line trial going on, but it will be more toxic to get trastuzumab deruxtecan every 3 weeks than just trastuzumab pertuzumab every 3 weeks. So that will have to be taken into consideration. You might be able to do an induction and then drop the ADC and use antibodies. But I think where the really next exciting trial is, besides first line, is in the post-neoadjuvant setting. So if the T-DXd was so much better than T-DM1, I mean, double the duration of response, more than double, way more than double, then it also may tremendously change outcome for patients who have residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and potentially could even be an adjuvant or neoadjuvant treatment option on its own. So that's where that information, besides changing practice now, I think that's where the next steps are. In terms of toxicity, you know, we still have to deal with the nausea, which is an issue, but the ILD, I think the two things, the institution of very strict management of toxicity and awareness, as well as treating patients who are less heavily pretreated, perhaps, eliminated the mortality in a large phase 3 multicenter trial from T-DXd. Really, really important. That doesn't mean that people won't get grade 2 ILD and have to stop treatment, but it does mean that we can manage a potentially life-threatening toxicity.
You were referring to the chemo effects of T-DXd, which I kind of didn't really appreciate when the drug first came out, but I keep hearing that from people. I've heard it described as somewhere between T-DM1 and actual chemotherapy. Is that what you see? And what do you see in terms of alopecia there?
Well, so for the chemo effect, I think, you know, it depends on what chemo you're talking about. So it has more toxicity than potentially some chemotherapies for some patients. I mean, some patients tolerate capecitabine well, and some patients think it's the worst thing they ever encountered, worse than a taxane. So there is really, I think, a big variation in tolerability of treatment. And the same is true for a T-DXd. I have a patient who's been on, who was on Destiny Breast 01, so she's been on for almost 4 years. And she has a little nausea, but it's like nothing. And then I have a patient who threw up 5 times every single cycle. So, you know, these are, it's that degree of variation. And I've found that, you know, giving patients olanzapine at bedtime, and then, you know, at some point you have to say uncle and dose reduce. Dose reducing helps a lot too. One of my patients had terrible diarrhea, completely went away when I dose reduced. So you do have to keep in mind that this is chemotherapy. Nausea, I have found, is more universal than maybe some other, certainly much more than T-DM1. And the curious thing about the nausea is there can be some nausea at day 2. You know, you can mainly manage that with anti-nausea drugs and more heavy-handedness. But the nausea around day 7 to 10 is, for some people, more difficult. It's sort of a delayed nausea, and then they feel pretty good after that. So overall, I think we can manage it, but you need to keep in mind that some patients may need to dose reduce. The alopecia is curious because it's really spotty. I mean, among people as opposed to in the scalp. So grade 1 alopecia, universal. Everybody gets a little bit of hair loss. But grade 2 alopecia, which is complete hair loss, I have seen in 2 patients, and I've given a lot of T-DXd. So I think that the one patient, this is, I mean, and other people have commented on this, this isn't just me, but, you know, complete hair loss, right? She's the patient who had horrible nausea and diarrhea, dose reduced, you know, on study. Everything went away. Nausea, diarrhea completely resolved, and her hair all grew back, and her hair is better now than before she lost it on T-DXd. She has a full head of hair. So I think that, you know, this, when you do dose reduce, it tends to come back. It's clearly dose related. Even people who lost some hair, it can fill in again on therapy. And people who've been on for years can have hair thinning late. So you just have to warn patients. It's just one of those toxicities, not universal, but part and parcel. And because it's so efficacious, I think people are willing to put up with it.
We're presenting, like, I think 45 video cases next week. So I'm busy editing everything. And I've got this case we're going to present in the HER2 one with a patient with a lot of residual disease after neoadjuvant thing. I think like 8 positive nodes, a lot of tumor. If you could, would you use T-DXd in a post-neoadjuvant setting in a patient like that?
You know, it's such a hard question because we don't have, I mean, we have 0 data in that setting. I think if I thought, you know, you certainly could make an argument. We use CDK4/6 inhibitors, for example, in people who had sort of essentially metastatic disease locally, you know, not completely resectable disease, even before we had approval through Monarch E. So you could liken it to that and say, you know, goodness, this patient has almost metastatic disease, but you have no idea that you're going to cure more patients yet. So, and the toxicity is greater, and it's hard to get, you know, approval for something that's not even approved in the first line setting. So I think that right now I would stick with T-DM1, and if they're ER positive, use neratinib in the extended adjuvant setting, rather than using T-DXd yet in that setting where we have just 0 data.
So lots of questions in the chat room about ILD. How do you monitor for it? Do you do pulmonary function tests? I've heard of people doing DLCOs. But do you anticipate that we're going to, with, you know, the more, you know, awareness of this and more monitoring, that this is going to be a safe alternative to bring into, you know, for example, adjuvant situation?
Yeah, I think the question is going to be, and, you know, it's interesting, the question in this post-neoadjuvant trial, like a la Catherine trial comparing TDM1 to TDXD, is how are we going to manage and monitor the ILD? Because what I see in my practice is grade one ILD. So I see ground glass opacities, and then you hold drug, you give steroids, it goes away, you restart. Now, that's also the guidelines, you know, for that, that we follow very carefully. But we don't get CT scans for staging in the post-neoadjuvant setting. So you're going to have to do some sort of regular imaging in order to avoid symptomatic ILD in the post-neoadjuvant setting. And I haven't looked at that NSABP collaboration yet to see what's recommended. Because if you wait for my concern is that if you wait for people to be symptomatic, that's where they got into problems with DESTINY-Breast01. And that's where we got into problems with other ADCs like SID985, is that if you wait for people to be symptomatic and you don't manage grade one asymptomatic ILD, you could have problems. And I will comment on the PFT thing, which I just was having a big discussion with another ADC exploratory phase one trial, because they were like, well, PFTs are, you could do them if you wanted, but we think they're a good idea, so everybody should have PFTs. And I was like, well, but PFTs I think are useless. I mean, we have zero data that a DLCO or PFTs beforehand predict risk of ILD. And if you have enough ILD to have PFT changes, you should have already stopped drug and given them steroids. So to me, PFTs are like a little, you know, like taking Valium. They don't change the problem, but they make you maybe feel better.
Interesting. All right, Hope, let's make some rounds here. We've got some great cases for you today. And I want to start out with this first case as a patient who's 65 years old. And really what I want to know about this case, Hope, is why. Why is this patient different than other patients with HER2-positive metastatic disease? This is a patient of Dr. Raman Sood. Here's Dr. Sood.
She presented almost 14 years ago with inflammatory breast cancer. She had neoadjuvant TCH back then and did not have a very good response. Soon after, she developed pulmonary metastases, which were confirmed on a biopsy. So she did receive some trastuzumab combinations with different chemos. A year later, pertuzumab was approved and available. So we added that to trastuzumab. And she has since then stayed on a combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab 8 years now. And she gets scans every 6 months and there's no active disease. That brings up the question, you know, is she cured now? It's been 8 years of no disease progression. Would you ever consider stopping treatment, give it a break, although she's tolerating it pretty well?
And I was just flashing back when the DESTINY-03 came out. A couple of days later, we did a webinar with Dr. Tulaney, and she used the C word as a possibility. Are we now thinking about curing metastatic breast cancer? You know, the practical issues of whether you stop or not, I'm, you know, curious about what, you know, how you think that through. But what I'm really curious about is, so we learned, this is an age-old question that goes back to Dr. Slayman's first patients. What's different about these people who respond for years and years? Is it the host? Is it the tumor combination? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, we already knew we cured some people with metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer. And I have patients like this in my practice, including a patient with a brain metastasis, a couple of patients that was resected and are, you know, well, 15 years later. So the big questions about when to stop, et cetera, are significant and are a clinical research question as well. But we can comment on that in a moment. But the question is, who are those people? If you look at the long-term outcome of CLEOPATRA that Sandy Swain published, so it was a median of 8-year follow-up, there was something like, I think, 16% or so of patients who were without progression at 8 years. Those patients don't progress. So we already know we have that group of patients who can be cured. And it's more common with de novo metastatic disease. It's more common with patients who have HER2-enriched intrinsic subtype and patients who don't have multiple mutations. I think, you know, I have found I'm having a greater appreciation of the beneficial information from intrinsic subtype for both patients, you know, for patients with all subtypes. So we know HER2 enriched have better PCR rates than the luminal B type HER2 positive cancers. I think that they tend to, the disease tends to melt away faster. And those who don't tend to have other mutations. So they have mutations in PIK3CA, they have loss of P53. The more common things that we see that really are associated with more resistance and recurrence of disease. And then in these people who have long responses, you know, we've generally, some people use 5 years, but I've used the 10-year mark. At 10 years, I talk to people about stopping if they have no toxicity. Some people are okay with it, but some people, you know, I have one patient with good lung mets, and actually it wasn't until she was third line that she was NED, but she continued on HP, and she was just too nervous to stop. So we switched her to the subcutaneous version of trastuzumab and pertuzumab. I think she's year 14 or something. Eventually, I'll get her off, but I always talk to people at year 10, and usually, I would say at least half of the people stop.
You always talk to people at year 10. Wow, what a thought. You know, it's amazing, again, in this virtual world that we get so much content flying by us. And I've said this about 10 times this week, which is, I never heard that before, which is, I never heard about the 16% long-term survival in Cleopatra. You know, the lung people brag about the high PD-L1. They have 20-25% of people making it to 5 years. But you're saying with, you know, we've already seen that, which I didn't know. Anyhow, you were mentioning about brain mets, and I want you to listen to a case. And I think this case, if we presented before Destiny-03, would have been pretty straightforward. But I am curious how you think through cases like this nowadays. Here's Dr. Gosain.
67-year-old postmenopausal presented with a mammogram concerning for right upper outer quadrant lesion, 5 centimeter in size. Staging scans for multiple liver lesions, lung lesions, and liver biopsy confirmed the metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer. Initiated on THP for about 6 months, had T-DM1. 6 months into the therapy there, she presented with altered mental status with MRI showing multiple subcentimeter brain lesions. Liver and lung lesions were also increasing in size. What is the third line therapy? And the second question I have is, would one go ahead with localized therapy with SRS to the brain therapy? I had referred her to radiation oncology, getting a prior authorization on tucatinib trastuzumab MK-azacitidine for now.
So these kinds of third line questions with CNS mets were pretty straightforward. Maybe they still are. Are you still thinking tucatinib in a situation like this?
So I think, you know, one of the things you first want to look at is the I guess it's not really disease-free interval, but the duration of response, right? So this patient got THP and had PD after 9 months and is ER negative HER2-positive disease. So first you're thinking this is a weird HER2-enriched disease, but, you know, HER2-enriched, but has something else going on. And, you know, you might want to recheck. He's, you know, the Dr. Gosain said it was checked in liver and breast. So, you know, this is HER2-positive, but, you know, maybe the copy number is 25, which has been associated with very high copy numbers with poor response, or there's a PIK3CA mutation or something else going on. So it might be worthwhile, although I don't know that it would help you with treatment, doing some genomic sequencing. And I've seen sometimes problems with that also. And then the TDM1 part, you know, had only six, I think he said 6 months or so, and was already progressing, and with multiple brain lesions. So I think the first thing, you know, the question about using SRS, this patient presented with symptoms. So this is a patient who needs treatment for brain mets. And if she has many lesions and a lot of edema, that's a situation where you have to do whole brain radiation. If the patient had like 4 mets or a big one with edema, I would treat with steroids and then do SRS, stereotactic so-called radiosurgery or radiation, because I think that, you know, we leave less of the brain impacted. And I have the sense that if you do whole brain and then you have to keep cleaning up over time with SRS, that we get more cognitive impairment because the actual amount of radiation that's delivered for the single lesion is greater with SRS than when you do whole brain radiation. So then the question is, what do you do with her there? I mean, I think that it's really hard because she had such a terrible response to the first 2 lines of therapy. And we really don't have any data on, although it's being studied, on combining, you know, alpelisib, for example, with other agents. And you have to be cautious about toxicity. That's being evaluated in the EPIC-B2 trial in the first line setting. So we need to see that data in order to know how to use the drug in practice. But I think that for a patient like this, because of the survival data in patients with active brain mets with tucatinib, I would still use the HER2CLIMB regimen first. And, you know, I have seen a patient that we had already done whole brain on, and we couldn't give additional radiation because she had multiple new growing lesions. And she has had an unbelievably dramatic response to HER2CLIMB type regimen after 3 months. Another patient didn't have such a great response with a single lesion, but this ability to treat patients for whom radiation might not be adequate and who have symptomatic CNS disease, along with radiation, I think is a really important part of using that triplet combination. Now, we have seen that T-DXd in patients with stable brain mets had the same tremendous efficacy. I mean, the forest plot all lines up to the left of one with all fabulous hazard ratios. So if you had stable brain mets in the DESTINY-Breast03, you had the same benefit. And there's a little tiny trial that looked at patients who had active brain mets, really small numbers, that was presented at ESMO 21. And in that trial, it looked like there was some response to brain mets from T-DXd, but there just isn't as much data. So I go where the data was, and then I would know that T-DXd could be effective in this patient as a next line therapy.
You mentioned that this patient didn't do that great on first and second line therapy, although, as you said, that the receptors were checked. When you have a lot of other cases where receptors switch, they get less, and you know, you start worrying, are they really HER2 positive after treatment? Do you lean more towards T-DXd in those kinds of situations? And any expectations / hopes or predictions about what we're going to see?
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be ASCO next year, along with the sacituzumab and hormone receptor positive breast cancer, hoping for both. But the HER2 low, trastuzumab deruxtecan, in my experience in HER2 low disease, is phenomenally effective. I have to manage this nausea and ILD, but it is really a very effective therapy. So I have had actually patients just like this that you mentioned, Neil, that are, you do the liver biopsy, finally, they're like third line therapy in the metastatic setting. They've already, been on 5 endocrine lines, right? And you biopsy it and the HER2 ratio comes back as 2.15 or 2.2. And you're like, is this really HER2 positive? But it fits all the criteria for HER2 positivity, and they never were before. And in that patient population, I definitely would go with T-DXd before I would go with a HER2CLIMB type regimen, because, tucatinib is less likely to work in that population of patients who have really probably very patchy HER2 amplification.
So I think the algorithm for breast cancer is starting to look more like lung cancer. If we have to start factoring in HER2 low, add a triple negative, ER positive, we already have BRCA. It's starting to sound, like I said, a little bit like non-small cell, but that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
I think we're also learning what ER low is. So that's going to be another next topic of great interest. Like, what is the 1-9%,
Yeah, right. We have plenty of cases where that comes up. All right, let's get back into the weeds of clinical practice. And we were talking about brain mets and talking about tucatinib. Dr. Agarwal has a 56-year-old woman with brain mets who actually started out being treated with a Cleopatra approach and then went on the HER-CLIMB regimen. Here's Dr. Agarwal.
For patients who have asymptomatic progression of brain metastases who will be treated with tucatinib, would you recommend the radiation oncologist to proceed with SRS or attempt to control with systemic therapy? If she had leptomeningeal carcinomatosis, would your answer change? What would be your preferred treatment in that case? She had a lot of tolerability issues with tucatinib, capecitabine, trastuzumab, including GI toxicity with nausea, vomiting, decreased PO intake, volume depletion, and diarrhea. How would you manage those toxicities with the triple therapy regimen? Do you first reduce tucatinib, or do you first reduce capecitabine, or both at the same time?
What's your current situation?
She progressed on tucatinib and is now on trastuzumab deruxtecan and is doing well.
Responding?
She is responding.
So your clinical experience with tolerability of HER2CLIMB, and how do you deal with it? Have you seen this level of toxicity? How do you deal with it? If you do dose reduction, what do you reduce?
Well, so, we see, you can always see something with a drug that's an N of one, or, you know, but this is not an N of one. If you give capecitabine to enough patients, you're going to see patients who don't tolerate capecitabine. And I was just trying to explain this to a patient in clinic yesterday that, you know, there is a tiny percent of patients who don't metabolize 5-FU at all, right? They get desperately ill. But there's a bigger swath of patients who are intermediate metabolizers, and we don't measure for it. It's really hard because there are a lot of enzymes playing a role here. So it's complex. In those patients, I think, you know, very tiny doses of capecitabine may be appropriate. And I think if you look at HER2CLIMB, capecitabine was the most commonly dose reduced drug and held and discontinued. So in a patient like that, who's responding to therapy but not tolerating it, I would dose reduce, you know, first of all, I would hold the capecitabine until the symptoms improved, continue to catinib and trastuzumab so that you could isolate which drug is causing the side effect. And then I would dose reduce the capecitabine. I've changed to 1 week on, 1 week off. And I've even given 500 milligrams twice a day for some patients who are really poor metabolizers, and they tolerate the capecitabine better. So yes, I have seen that. And I think we do see it. We can also see some liver enzyme elevations in those patients as well. So you just have to be, you know, when you're not a patient on a trial, you can hold drug and dose reduce. You can always go back up again. And I think patients just do much, much better managing that. The question that was asked about SRS, or do you manage systemically? Generally, I treat with focal radiation if a patient has not had radiation before, if it's not a huge area, if it's not a big issue about causing more problems for the patient in cognitive or other issues. You know, you don't think it's radiation necrosis, all these different issues. I think that a situation where I might treat systemically first is a patient who has a punctate lesion where they think it might be cancer and they're not sure, you know, might as well wait on the radiation. You're not in any hurry. You know, these like sort of pinpoint things. I hate radiating those. So that's a situation where I would wait.
Leptomeningeal disease, is tucatinib, HER-CLIMB work there?
So that's a great question. There's actually a poster spotlight, I think, at San Antonio from the Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium that is looking at the triplet in patients who have leptomeningeal disease. And, you know, so I'll certainly send you to that. But, you know, really small numbers of patients, but suggestive that you could see some efficacy with that triplet therapy. And there's a lot of interest in further evaluations of these different approaches in patients with LMD. And you know that there were studies looking at intrathecal trastuzumab, et cetera, but that sort of didn't really pan out quite as well as we wanted them to. I mean, this is a tough area to treat, and but I think of great interest.
So, interesting question in the chat room from Omaima. Bilateral breast cancer, HER2 positive, hormone positive, BRCA positive. On the third year of, three years out in terms of adjuvant therapy, you know, status post adjuvant therapy, question is delayed olaparib. And, you know, it's interesting because somebody brought up, I didn't remember this, and when you were mentioning the original trastuzumab studies in 2005, and, you know, after when they came out, people were using trastuzumab in patients who had been treated previously, I think even up to 2 or 3 years. First of all, what about olaparib and PARP inhibitors in HER2? And second of all, what about delayed use of olaparib or PARP inhibitor?
You know, it's really interesting because you're sort of balancing between two targeted therapies driven by genomics. I think in HER2 positive disease, you know, there's not a lot of BRCA positivity in HER2 positive disease, but we do see it. And I have a patient like this she has de novo metastatic disease and hormone receptor negative. But if a patient it says on the third year of adjuvant treatment with hormone therapy. So I don't know if the patient got neoadjuvant therapy, had a path CR, but presumably completed 1 year of HER2 targeted therapy. Depending on the extent of disease, you know, we might have considered even neratinib in the second year. But these patients were excluded from the Olympia trial and from the Olympiad trial. I have given a PARP inhibitor to a patient who has BRCA2 HER2-positive disease. And, you know, she had cardiac issues, although she's been able to go back on HER2-targeted therapy. And she stayed on with endocrine therapy in combination for about a year, but she's been on HER2-targeted therapy for longer. My general bias would be not to give late olaparib. It does have toxicities, and we don't know that it would benefit a patient. And in most of these cases, HER2 and ER are driving the tumor. If you think about Olympia, not only was HER2 not included, but the majority of patients by far had BRCA1 and triple negative breast cancer, not hormone receptor positive. So again, we just don't have the data to use it in this situation.
Yeah, really interesting. So let's go into another case. Now we're going to get into a pretty unusual case, something that I've never seen a case of before. So it's a young woman. And what's different about her is when they sent out germline testing, they found that she had some kind of variation in terms of TP53 mutation. Here's Dr. Zafar talking about the case.
ERPR HER2 positive on the right breast and ERPR positive HER2 negative on the left breast. She did have a solitary liver lesion on the right hepatic lobe, and that was biopsy. It was ER positive, HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer. Of interest, she had a germline mutation, you know, testing questionable P53 mutation, raising the concern whether she had leaf Romani genotype. Genetic counselors from City of Hope concluded that she may have some of the mosaicism of P53 mutation, definitely putting her at a higher risk of other malignancies. This was one of those patients where, what do we do? But initially, we treated her with the triplet, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and docetaxel. The right breast mass shrank significantly. We simultaneously was also starting ovarian suppression. After good result, she had a very residual liver disease. We decided to provide a stereotactic radiotherapy to the liver. And the question always comes up, what to do with the primary tumor? For a 33-year-old, you want to do whatever you can to give her the best chance.
So I don't know how familiar you might be with this genetic syndrome. Knowing you, you probably had 3 patients or 5 patients with
yes,
it.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah. But I guess what I'd be curious about, because it also introduces 2 important topics, patients with oligomets and management of a primary in a patient with metastatic disease. So first, can you kind of talk about your general approach to a case like this in terms of oligomets? This is one's in the liver. And also management of the primary, and then how, if at all, you might change your approach based on this genetic abnormality.
Yeah, I mean, I think both are obviously really important. So first, this is a young woman with bilateral breast cancer, so the chance that she has some mutation that increased her risks is high. So I think, and a P53 is particularly important for a reason I'll mention just in a moment. But I think it's great that the treating physician biopsied her liver, because you have 2 different histologies and you really need to know that HER2 and the liver met. So I agree with the treatment that the patient received. Treatment of, you know, I would have treated exactly the same way. And now the patient is presumably on trastuzumab, pertuzumab, ovarian suppression, and endocrine therapy. So then I think there's a few different questions about this patient. So you know that the contralateral breast cancer is ER positive and HER2 negative. So you're treating it with the endocrine therapy and the ovarian suppression. There is a trial, the PATINA trial, that's looking at palbociclib or not in exactly the situation with, you know, only HER2 positive cancer, not 2 cancers. So I think that those results, I hope the trial is completed accrual, will be available soon. And, you know, there's a fair bit of preclinical data to support the use, as well as some clinical data of a CDK4/6 inhibitor's maintenance. So then the question is, if you have oligometastatic disease, you treated the liver with SRS, which is exactly what we would do, how can you be treating oligometastatic disease and leave the primaries? You know, that doesn't make any sense. So we don't know the node status, but in this situation, one might have considered doing a lumpectomy and radiation for the HER2 positive and ER positive cancers. But the problem is with P53, we don't radiate because we don't want to cause secondary cancer. So we only radiate with no alternatives. So in this situation, I think you'd have to really decide about bilateral mastectomies to avoid radiation therapy and avoid the risks of local recurrence and needing to radiate, because there is a chance that this patient could be cured of her disease. In other words, have very long-term disease control. Obviously she has a risk of other cancers you don't want to enhance. So this is what I would talk about. And I think this is a classic situation where you really need a multidisciplinary group to discuss options and the next steps.
So quick question, a case from the chat room from Muhammad. T3, N3, M0, HER2 positive, ERPR negative patient treated with a neoadjuvant therapy surgery, YPT1, N0. 1 month plus surgery, the patient has sternal mets biopsy proven that are triple negative, PD-L1 greater than 10%. So I'll just say that the doc says, would you combine pembro, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and chemo? But I guess I'll just ask you, what do you think about this case and what would you do?
Well, it's actually really intriguing. And occasionally we do see these tumors where there's a lot of heterogeneity. I remember I treated a patient who presented with a very locally advanced cancer from way up north. And the biopsy of the node was HER2 positive. Because she had a 4-centimeter node and no identifiable breast tumor. And she had a great response. She went to surgery. And at the time of surgery, what was left in her node was triple negative. And there was no HER2 positive disease. And she had ER positive disease in her breast cancer, in her breast that was HER2 negative. So, you know, we can see this. It's not common, but it does suggest that there was a lot of heterogeneity in the breast itself. I would go back to the primary tumor. And one question which we don't know is whether or not that tumor at the time of surgery was retested for markers, and also if there's any other tumor from the initial core to be tested to understand the heterogeneity. Because HER2 was lost and she has PD-L1 positive disease, I would probably treat that patient with a KEYNOTE-355 type regimen with GemCarbo and pembrolizumab. The question about adding trastuzumab or not, it's pretty safe to do that. And I think that's really dealer's choice. In this situation, what I would want to do is control that sternal met and then be able to treat it as an oligometastatic disease site where I would give a focal radiation.
Okay, well, I'm going to run by some local cases in a second. But first, I want to go through a couple of the metastatic cases we presented in the survey and really just try to get people interested in taking a look at the slides in our slide deck. But I just want to get your take on a couple of metastatic questions we asked, and we highlighted your answers. So we presented a patient who had neoadjuvant treatment, post-neoadjuvant neratinib, and was on anastrozole for triple positive disease, who has a progression in the liver and brain. And it's kind of interesting there that you see a split. Before, I think a lot of people, most people would have said what's on the left side there, her climb. But now a couple of people, including you, are saying TDXD. And Dr. Tulaney says she wants to go back and repeat Cleopatra. Any comments?
So this is a patient who has ER-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer. She gets TCHP, presumably has residual disease. So in today, she would get T-DM1, but then that wasn't existing. So she got TP, essentially, and then neratinib. And, you know, you assume she had residual disease. And she's on adjuvant anastrozole. So this is 18 months after finishing neratinib. And the patient now has brain metastases. So my question here, you know, we always like pop in some questions there, but what about this and this and this? You know, we're trying to answer one, you know, you want us to just answer yes, no, right? But so what I would say is that because of the liver metastases and brain after all this, I liked the idea of giving trastuzumab deruxtecan because of the really dramatic results of DB03. But the brain, it really depends on what you have in brain. So if this was a lot of brain mets, I would use HER2 climb. If this was a single brain met treated with SRS, I would use trastuzumab deruxtecan. And if she was symptomatic with brain mets, for example, I'd be more likely to use HER2 climb. I wouldn't go back to a Cleopatra-like regimen because the patient had it. You know, I think you could use it at some point, but the patient was fairly aggressively pretreated, and I am assuming that with TCHP, she did not have a PCR because of the use of neratinib in the post-neoadjuvant setting. So that's why I didn't think about a Cleopatra-like regimen, although I would in a great responder who was 3 years out, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I wouldn't do that here.
So interesting comment by Dr. Kumar in the chat room, going back to that case that was presented by somebody else in the chat room.
Yes.
Of the sternal met, which is, can you believe a bone assay for HER2?
And I think that's a really important point we didn't deal with, it being triple negative. But I have to say, it HER2 is, you know, gene amplification for HER2 tends to hang around even when you decalcify bone, which is the issue that Dr. Kumar is bringing up. I think, and it's a really important issue, and it's particularly important for ER. I think you lose ER a lot when you're looking at it with immunohistochemistry, and even RNA in bone when you decalcify bone. So in these situations, when I do a bone biopsy, we don't decalcify it. And in the sternum, that's fairly easy because you can get the bone marrow. We actually talk to our pathologists in advance. They tease out the cells and try and look specifically by FISH for HER2 gene amplification. But it makes me think that the original HER2 might have been a little, and I didn't mention this before, but just might have been a little bit borderline. And if the, for example, ratio is low between 2 to 3, we lose that a lot in patients when their cancers progress. And I think there is, you know, there's been some interesting work by a variety of investigators, including Otto Metzger at Dana-Farber about heterogeneity of HER2. And it is quite interesting because what ends up happening is one clone survives and it may not be the HER2 clone. But in, I think it's really important what Dr. Kumar brought up, that if you have done a bone biopsy and you see something that's triple negative, you have to be really cautious. I mean, I have a patient who's now been on abemaciclib and endocrine therapy for almost a year from having her bone biopsy that showed triple negative disease. So, you know, this is a patient who had a phenotype of ER-positive breast cancer, but nothing else to biopsy.
Okay, another question from the survey. You know, people were asking about this in the chat room. What kind of ILD toxicity does it take you to hold or discontinue TDXD? This is what we call a consensus. Any comments?
Well, we have a consensus because we're following the guidelines. And I think in a situation where you saw mortality and it went away when we followed guidelines, that is a really good reason to follow guidelines. So I think, you know, the guidelines state that if you have symptomatic ILD, you should stop the drug permanently. And that appears to have avoided the mortality along with the less treatment that these patients had. But I will say, what's coming up now is people are having these fabulous responses and staying on therapy, and they get, you know, a cough, and at home their kid is sick with the virus, and they have a cough, and they have ground glass opacities on their CT. So then does that, and it goes away, you put them on steroids, it goes away. Does that mean you could never retest with TDXD? And my answer to that is, I think you have to individualize it. I mean, if a patient has a cough and they're not short of breath and they're not hypoxic and all of that, and you think something else could have caused their cough, you know, because people get allergies. I mean, you know, there's just so many things. Then, and you may have ground glass opacities at the same time. In that situation, I might cautiously retest.
So I want to go on and talk about local therapy. We have a couple cases, but before we get to the case, I was going through the slides that people were sending in for next week, and I saw a very interesting slide in the slide deck for Dr. Carey for next week's program on HER2 positive disease. I'd never seen this before, and I was real curious about it. So this is her slide, and at the top of the slide, she writes, "Catherine did not see a difference in terms of CNS relapse," which I was like, really? Wow, I have not heard that before. So we did a little research. We saw this paper that was just published in the Annals of Oncology, more data from the Catherine trial. I think it maybe has been presented or it was around, but I don't believe it was published. And this is what she put in her slide, that CNS recurrence was not reduced. Is that the way I'm reading that? And that's the way it is. Right.
Yeah, it's really interesting data. And this is sort of the updated data, but there was, you know, we're waiting for Catherine updates forever, and this is not it, I will point out, because this data had been part of the original presentation of Catherine. And then there were a number of different subset presentations that looked at CNS mets, looked at tiny little tumors, was it beneficial, et cetera, all the questions we had, which they tried to look at, but we don't have the longer term follow-up data. But what was fascinating with that first presentation of Catherine, which is now really flushed out in this paper, which looked at a lot of different subsets, actually, not just this. So I think it was important to, important to look at the paper, but is that what was shown is that the actual numerical patients who had first CNS event was higher with T-DM1 than trastuzumab, but that's just a fluke of overlap, right? 44 versus 32, because overall, there's absolutely no difference in CNS events in patients treated with T-DM1 or trastuzumab. So what we took home from that is that patients who have residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy for HER2-positive breast cancer have about a 5 to 6% risk of a subsequent CNS recurrence. We knew that. But T-DM1, despite the fact that it has some efficacy in brain mets, doesn't change that. And nothing we've done since the beginning of use of trastuzumab has changed that. So that has led to a lot of interest in whether or not tucatinib could change that incidence. But the incidence is so low, the trial that's looking at this, which is an NCI-sponsored trial through the Alliance, COMPASS-RD, is not actually looking at that as a primary endpoint. It's looking at PFS as a, event-free survival as a primary endpoint. And it's shown here, this is a trial that's accruing now. You can get any neoadjuvant therapy, you have residual disease, and then you're randomized to get T-DM1 or placebo or T-DM1 and tucatinib. And a secondary endpoint is a reduction in CNS recurrence. And, you know, there's already supportive data from the post-hoc subset analysis from Extenet, as is listed here. So I think this is a really cool trial. We're also, of course, going to see this as a secondary endpoint in the DESTINY trial that's being done with the NSABP and GBG, I believe, looking at residual disease and comparing T-DM1 to T-DXd.
All right. Well, let's get into some cases. And I'm going to start out with a case that where the question is pretty, been around there quite a while, but I'd like to get an updated response or thought from you about a common question I hear from oncologists, and the question of the use of anthracyclines in the localized disease setting. Here's Dr. Paswani.
She was sent to me by the surgeon to talk about neoadjuvant chemotherapy with anti-HER2 treatment. And so I spoke to her about doing anthracycline-based regimen versus TCHP, and she chose to do TCHP. And the only thing that made me suggest the anthracycline-based regimen in her case was the fact that she was 37 years old. And so my question is whether age should be taken into consideration in this situation. I think if she was older, she would have done fine with TCHP, but her age concerns me.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few different thoughts here. So first, in the randomized trials that have looked at anthracycline taxane, THP, versus TCHP, there hasn't been a big difference. So I think that there really is no significant difference at all. So I think that TCHP is a reasonable option, and nobody has ever shown a variation in outcome based on age. In a triple positive tumor, a young woman might benefit from ovarian suppression from TCHP more than from ACTHP. So who knows? And you don't want to do ovarian suppression with chemo anyway. The major issue I've had with TCHP is just enormous toxicity in some patients where they just don't tolerate the docetaxel carboplatin, huge big slug. And in those patients, and I have to say, we don't actually know that you need carboplatin for most of these patients. So I think that the COMPASS HER2, so that's the neoadjuvant portion of this COMPASS trials, is using just THP and surgery to try and see if that's enough. And the T could be either docetaxel or weekly paclitaxel. And patients who don't tolerate TCHP tolerate paclitaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and even weekly carbo much better. So my answer to that would be that I think these are reasonable regimens. If you're trying to preserve fertility for any very young woman, I wouldn't use TCHP because it's much more ovarian suppressive than other options that a patient might have. It's just the carbo big slug and the docetaxel every 3 weeks. The other thing I think that's important is that in a patient who has triple positive disease, they're more likely to have luminal B than HER2 enriched disease. And the PCR rates are lower in this group than the HER2 enriched and ER negative type population. So I don't think you're going to be able to say, oh, she didn't have a PCR, should have given her AC, you know? And you think about it, when a patient's so young, might as well eliminate that tiny 0.3% risk of secondary cancer, you know, secondary malignancy with hematologic cancers that can be seen with anthracyclines.
Ever hear of CPX 351? Liposomal cytarabine, doxorubicin. We were talking about that last night on our AML program with Dr. Wee. We had a case that broke my heart. It was a patient who had a history of breast cancer. And when you really went back and looked at it, the first doc recommended a non-anthracycline regimen. She went to a second opinion, recommended anthracycline. I mean, who knows whether or not that was really the cause, and unfortunately developed AML. CPX is used specifically in secondary cancers. I want to show you another case. And again, I've heard a bunch of these cases, sort of surprise cases, what happens at surgery after not getting neoadjuvant therapy. This question of what do you do when you have a patient with a small HER2-positive lesion, a 1 centimeter or smaller, do you give neoadjuvant or not? This was a case where the patient had a 1 centimeter tumor. They sent her to surgery and got a little bit of a surprise. Here's Dr. Gupta.
She's a nurse. She's 63 years old, 1 centimeter lymph node negative disease clinically. We decided to proceed with surgery. She had a 1.8 centimeter grade 3 invasive ductal carcinoma and 3 positive lymph nodes on sentinel lymph node biopsy. So they took her back to the OR, did an axillary lymph node dissection, and she had 6 more positive lymph nodes. And, you know, totally took me by surprise, because now I'm wondering, oh, gosh, I could have given her neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And patient was a little disappointed, too. I thought that I'll treat her with 6 cycles of DCHP and empirically change her treatment to TDM1, assuming that she never had a response for a total duration of 1 year. Is this something that experts would think is reasonable for this patient? And then number 2, she's likely to benefit from 1-year-long therapy of neratinib. I was also thinking of enrolling her on a clinical trial to see if she could benefit from abemaciclib in the HER2-positive setting. So what would be more important, you know, continued HER2 blockade or HR pathway blockade?
So, you know, Hope, we've done almost 2,000 of these cases since the pandemic started, not just breast cancer, of course. And, you know, it touches me so much that docs are willing to put out their thoughts, their treatments, et cetera, for people to take a look at. This is a kind of a pretty wild suggestion to just go ahead and use TDM1. Any comments?
Well, I mean, one comment is that I try, when I see these patients with HER2 positive disease or triple negative disease, I always make sure somebody's done a really good axillary ultrasound, because, you know, it would be unusual not to feel 9 nodes. So maybe she's kind of a bigger girl and doesn't, maybe it's harder to feel under her arm. And I think, you know, the surgeon sometimes will send you a message, would you do surgery or neoadjuvant therapy? We have a 1 centimeter clinically node negative patient. And so I think we always have to be cautious to make sure that people have really carefully evaluated these tumors that can be smaller with multiple positive nodes. The other thing, you know, we generally wouldn't stage for 1 centimeter. So ultrasound, I think, is the way to go. In terms of the treatment, I think TCHP is good. Again, we do have limited, you know, you wouldn't expect that patient to necessarily have a PCR. One thing you could do is to see whether or not the tumor is HER2 enriched or not by doing a mammoprint looking at blueprint, but, you know, I don't know, you know, insurance might not cover that, but I think it would be quite interesting and it may actually be beneficial for us in the future. I'm of 2 minds here. I mean, I think doing the TCHP, completing 1 year of HP, adding an endocrine therapy and giving 1 year of neratinib would be sort of our standard approach right now. I do understand that when somebody has so much disease, you want to do more. And I don't think she would be wrong for using the, you know, post neoadjuvant TDM1 approach and then following it with neratinib. I mean, this patient needs all the help she can get, and with endocrine therapy. I probably wouldn't take the abemaciclib approach right away, but I also think that's quite reasonable to use abemaciclib. We just don't have as much data, and we have the phase 3 trial with the neratinib. I think, we have the MONARCH HER data, which suggests that abemaciclib is quite active in the metastatic setting. But the patient would be, you know, she has 9 positive nodes and she presumably would be randomized to get abemaciclib or not. So I think that would be the biggest decision, is are you willing to randomize to no abemaciclib, because you're going to know right away.
So I'm been waiting for somebody in the chat room to say, what about ctDNA? So I'll ask you that in a second as a guidance here. But also, I was trying not to ask you this question, but I've got, because we're talking about HER2, but I got to ask you about the abema indication. Do I read that correctly, saying node positive key 67, that's it? That's what they say in the FDA indication, not the criteria of the trial. Is that the way you read it? Is that the way payers are reading this thing?
I don't know about payers because it's complex and it can be the Ki-67 at diagnosis, not at surgery, right? If you gave neoadjuvant therapy. So we're always going back and searching for that Ki-67. But I actually spoke to people from the FDA about this. Many of us did because I think we were perplexed that, you know, it didn't really make sense that you had a trial which showed benefit and then you looked at the subset and they approved it in the subset, you know? There was benefit seen, albeit a little less in the Ki-67 lower group, but you know, the trial was designed, as you know, there was only a small subset who enrolled only on Ki-67. But when they took out all those Ki-67 centrally 20% or greater, the benefit was bigger. So what the FDA said is that they were trying to sort of make a risk versus benefit analysis. Most of the patients have finished 3 years of therapy, but it's a really early endpoint in ER positive disease. So they want to go a little bit farther out. So I would expect that if the results continue to be good in the overall population, that they'll expand the authorization eventually. And that this was a initial step to try and benefit patients who have the worst outcome with very early, you know, front-loaded risk of recurrence.
So yeah, that'll be really interesting to see what happens. But I read that thing as saying node positive, Ki-67, and not
20% greater.
20% or greater, but not the four positive nodes and all the other stuff in the trial. So okay.
And well, also they used a platform where they looked at the whole Ki-67, and we have generally reported the highest areas. So my pathologist asked me and I said, no, just report the highest areas. We want to get people on the drug.
This is like studying the Talmud, like the you can talk about it forever. Okay. So I'm going to give you a minute to do a quick San Antonio HER2 preview. We pulled out the titles of the orals. You're doing the SOPHIA trial, which I think we had seen with margituximab. We just mentioned Sarah Hurvitz's trial. There's the Phoebe study of baratinib, but also a very interesting study in HER2 positive disease with neratinib, fulvestrant, trastuzumab, the SUMMIT trial. Anything that's this last presentation looking at mechanisms of resistance, anything you want to sort of alert us to in terms of these papers?
I think so just to talk first about the in some ways, the easiest thing, piratinib. I think there were something like 14 or 16 abstracts on piratinib from various trials. It's a oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor, more similar to neratinib, high rate of diarrhea that's been studied in China and really has a lot of efficacy. But the one issue with these trials, and I think it's phenomenal to have the availability of this drug in a country where access to many HER2 targeted therapies has been quite limited. And in other parts of the world where access is limited, this is an oral agent that will be presumably less expensive in other areas of the world. But the thing is that the patients were not treated the way we treat our patients. So not everybody had had pertuzumab, T-DM1, you know, trastuzumab, et cetera. So we don't really know how this agent would stack up in patients who had received all of the aggressive prior treatments. Phase 3 SOPHIA trial, you know, we're very interested in the impact of margituximab in patients who have the low affinity IgG Fc gamma receptor with the F allele. The overall survival data in a press release was not significantly different between the two arms, although PFS was. But there's a trend that's quite fascinating in patients who have the F allele, particularly patients who are homozygous, and that's being studied in the neoadjuvant MARGO trial in our Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium, and Ian Kropp is the PI. T-DXd, this is really showing additional subset analyses from DESTINY-Breast03, and of course, we already know from the forest plots that all the subsets benefited. So all the subsets benefit. So we're going to just see that in a little more granularity. And then I think it's worthwhile calling out the last two as well. The SUMMIT trial is really interesting with neratinib in patients who have HER2 negative but acquired mutations in somatic mutations in HER2 metastatic breast cancer. This is much more common in patients who have, interestingly, hormone receptor positive lobular cancers where you see more HER2 mutations. There's also going to be an interesting presentation in patients who have a high tumor mutational burden, also seen more in lobular cancers. I mean, I have a patient who had a tumor mutational burden of 70 or something with a lobular cancer. You never see that. So that trial is looking at immunotherapy, and it's worthwhile. I think it's called Nimbus. It's worthwhile looking for that too. This the Summit trial is interesting because I think we know that neratinib works in this patient population, and trying to enhance the efficacy, including a blocker of all three pathways, is, you know, really interesting. So look for that data. There's a randomized trial ongoing, a small phase two randomized, and tucatinib is being studied in this setting. And then the genomic analysis actually really speaks to one of the questions you asked me, which is, you know, why are patients responding well versus not well? And I think that this is a really interesting abstract, just looking at these pathway alterations that we might be able to target better in the future.